I'm Om Hal Wolf. If you haven't already read it up on the bulletin board, I retired in January from ALC and LCA pastorates after 42 years in the ministry, and this is my eighth time up here at Holden on the faculty. Starting back in 62, I came up here. My qualifications for doing a Bible study are varied, not only being a pastor, but I taught Old Testament and Hebrew and archaeology in several seminaries, mainly in Maywood, the old Chicago Lutheran Seminary, for about 9 years, and then a couple of other seminaries for a year or a semester or so on, from off and on. What we're going to do, if you're here for 3 days, that's when I leave Saturday, for Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, we're going to have a little mini course in the Psalms. We're going to take three Psalms. We did two Psalms last week. Some of the people who were here on the staff have been in. We did Psalm 8 in general, and then we did Psalm 51. This time we're going to do Psalm 103, Psalm 50, which is an oddball psalm, which many people don't spend a lot of time on, and I picked it deliberately, and Psalm 22, so that 51, 103, and 22 are very familiar to many people. 50 is not very familiar, so that's it. Now, when we start thinking about the Psalms, I'd like to make a few general remarks first, and with a small group like we have here, there'll be time for you to interrupt me any time. Most of the time, we talk about it as the Psalms of David. The Psalms of David sounds as if we're talking about David wrote them all. It doesn't necessarily mean that. He may have composed some, and some of the headings that you see, which it says of David, or a Psalm of David, or of Moses, or something like that, really are much later additions than the Hebrew. When you heard St. Jerome mentioned here, even St. Jerome has different headings in some of his Psalms than we have in ours, and the Greek Bible had still other translations from the Hebrew for the headings as to when they took place. My theory is, and a lot of people agree with me and some people disagree with me, that the word Psalms of David are like saying the royal hymn book or the hymn book of the king. Just like when you say Wesley's hymn book, you're not insisting that Wesley wrote all the hymns in it. You're saying this is the collection that was used by Wesleyans or by Wesley himself and gathered them together. And so the Psalms may or may not all date from the time of David, as even though they have that title. The word David is also, like Umhau, a strange name, although we've taken it for granted it's an easy name. David is a name that can also be translated like Umhau can. Umhau means cut around or hew around. Some of you are asking before we begin. And so if I were English, my name would probably be Forester or Woodsman or something like that. But David also means chief of a tribe. It's found in other than Hebrew languages with that meaning. And that's where I suggest that maybe we're saying the Psalms of David or Psalms for David mean Psalms for the royal chapel or Psalms for the royalty. After all, Solomon's temple was really his private little chapel. It only became later a chapel for all the people, or a temple for all the people. And so that's the first thing we need to say. Then we need to say one other thing about the Psalms. There are some Psalms that are much older than David. There are some Psalms that maybe are even older than Moses. Not only the one that is supposedly written by Moses, as the title says, but some of the others are. Psalm 29 is probably older than Moses. Because of the kind of language that's used. There are two major types of psalms, and then a few odd types, but let's make one of them is the one we're going to do today. That's Psalm 103, which is sort of a praise hymn kind of a psalm. It's praising God, and usually it's praising the covenant God that I'll talk about when we get to the first line. Then the next big group, besides praise and hymn kind of things, are laments. And Psalm 51 and Psalm 22 are obviously immense, aren't they? Something's happened in either the life of the country or the nation or the life of an individual. So, have mercy on me, O Lord. That's a prayer of lament. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Obviously, that's a prayer of lament to begin with. It has some other things when it finishes. Then there are prayers like the 150 we're going to do. 50 is a covenant renewal psalm. A judgment that has a lot of prophetic things in it, and we'll see that tomorrow. Then there's Psalms of enthronement, when both the king and God were enthroned as new rulers and a new covenant was made. Most of the Psalms that are quoted in the New Testament and used as sort of what you might call proof texts about Jesus' divinity or about Jesus as the Messiah, most of those Psalms were originally intended to say something about God and his king. The king has gone up. The Lord has gone up with a shout. So Psalm 110 is a good one. That's the most quoted psalm in the New Testament. That's another way in which you could characterize the Psalms. There are a few other types that I could mention, but I don't think we'll bore you with that. So before we begin with Psalm 103, are there any questions about the two little things I talked about now? Types of psalms and what it means when it has a little title on it. Any questions you want to ask about that? Even the situation that's given in the psalm is not necessarily true, although it's a good homiletical illustration. Some Jewish person, probably after the Babylonian captivity, said, "This fits this situation. Let's make a sermon on it." And so Psalm 51, for example, says, after Nathan had come to David about the Bathsheba affair. That's a good illustration of what that was all about. But that's not necessarily the historical time when it really happened. You know, David didn't sit down after he committed adultery and Nathan came in and said, "You're the man." He didn't then sit down and write Psalm 51, which is what a great many people traditionally have thought because of that title up there. There are also some musical notations in some of the psalms. And those musical notations are probably from the time of the Second Temple, not the time of David or Solomon, but later than that, when people chanted them. Just like the little notations that we have in the new hymn book, the new Lutheran Green hymn book that we used last night. You know, there are many different settings to sing the psalms to. And they had settings to sit the top, to sing the psalms to also. Okay, let's look at two things about the Psalms in general that Psalm 103 helps. Now, I have a King James, an RSV, and a Jerusalem Bible here because there are some things that each one helps us to get back to what the Psalm was really trying to say. First thing is about the names of God. In a lament, if you've really felt you're alienated from God or God's alienated from you, the covenant is all ripped apart, you very seldom use this top name. You very seldom talk about Yahweh, which is the phrase that's used in Hebrew. We don't know whether that's the way it was supposed to be pronounced or not. But the Jerusalem Bible always uses that. Whenever you see four capital letters in your King James or the RSV, L-O-R-D, and all four are capitalized, that's the word, the covenant God. Now in Psalm 51, he says, there's no Lord. He's alienated because of his rebellion and his sins, so he doesn't use that word. He uses a different word that I'll talk about in a minute. In Psalm 22, you've got a very interesting thing that we'll deal with Saturday, but some of you won't be there, and it fits this little introduction. The first 18 verses are God only, because he feels alienated. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? He doesn't say, my Yahweh, or my covenant God. But at Psalm 19, it changes. And he says, Yahweh. Yahweh has heard me. Yahweh has answered me. Yahweh has delivered me. And I will tell all the people about the great deeds of Yahweh. And he shifted. Now, 100 years ago, people would say, that was proof that there were two psalms that got stuck together. And they try to say, well, the first 18 was one psalm, and the last 20-some verses, a different psalm. Now we know better. We recognize the theological shift in mood. It's like our change from a confessional service to a celebration of Easter and forgiveness. That's what happens in Psalm 22. And if you do that, you can use different names. Now, we in our service don't use the names that way, but we could if we wanted to be consistent. We could say, O God, be merciful to me, a sinner, in our confessional service. And then we could say, thanks be to Christ who has forgiven us our sins. And that would be consistent with what we're saying about these names. So when you see the word G-O-D, I haven't put that one up there. When you see G-O-D, that's the God that's the creator, the God that's remote, the God that even other people that Hebrews would acknowledge. It could even sometimes be in the plural. It's just a power. It might be personal power, but it is a power. And that word is E-L-L, or it has a particular, peculiar form, Elohim. But whenever you see the word G-O-D, it's related to that word El. And El stands, in Arabic as well as in Hebrew, it stands for strength. It stands for power. And so you're emphasizing the powerful God, the creator God, the God who can condemn too, the judging God in that. Now, the next one that I've got up here, you'll find with a capital L and three little letters. Capital L, but then O-R-D in small letters. And the King James and the RSV are very consistent. You pronounced it very well, Adonai, and that's the word, and it's a word that's in Canaanite, and it's in Babylonian, it's in a lot of Semitic languages, and it's in Hebrew, and Adonai means my Lord. Now you can say my Lord to King David, to Solomon, you could say my Lord to Nebuchadnezzar, you could say it if you were still speaking it, you could say it to Emperor Nero, if you were speaking Hebrew to him. You could also say it if you were a peasant or a serf. You could say it to the landowner you were working for. In other words, it's very close to the word that southern slaves used to say, Massa. Remember some of the old southern slave songs? Massa's in the old cold, cold ground. Massa, meaning master. Or if you're enough German to know the word Herr, H-E-R-R. Herr in Luther's Bible with a capital H usually stands for God. Herr, when it's used in another way, used for mister, and sometimes for the lord of the feudal castle. So that's what Adonai means. And you'll find that in some of the Psalms. For example, if we look at Psalm 8, where you're talking about God, if you see the first line, O Lord, our Lord, you note the first line says L-O-R-D with four capitals. The second word is L-O-R-D with only one capital. So it's saying, technically, if you looked in the King on the Jerusalem Bible or the Hebrew, it would say, O Yahweh, meaning O Covenant God, my or our boss, or our powerful God. You see, they're using two words. Whereas when you say it in English, O Lord, our Lord, you aren't sure that they're getting both. So he's calling on both the covenant God and the creator God in that particular thing. And he does that, you see. And then when he gets to verse 5, thou hast made him a little less than God. The King James had a little less lower than the angels. You remember that? They were a little afraid about making us almost God. Thou made him a little less than God. Then they're using that little L word again, E-L. You're less, you're a little lower than all the other gods that are around. And then the end, of course, is the same. Now, you've all heard of Jehovah's Witnesses, and then we're going to assume we're actually in Psalm 103, whether you know it or not, because it says, bless the Lord, O my soul. And if you look, you see you've got a particular kind of word there. You've got L-O-R-D with four capital letters. And it stays all the way through this psalm because this is a psalm of and a hymn of praise, a psalm of trust for the covenant God. And you can only appeal to a covenant God to forgive you on the basis of his previous historical lays. Now, Jehovah's Witnesses and the word Jehovah. The word Jehovah is a bastardized word. The reason I say we're not sure whether you should really pronounce this Hebrew word for the covenant God, Yahweh, is that ever since the time of Ezra, the Jews stopped pronouncing the word. They just didn't pronounce it at all because they took so literally the commandment, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. And they were enough psychologists in the popular sense to know that sometimes when you're saying your prayers, your mind wanders. Sometimes you're just mouthing our Father or whatever. And so that would be taking his name in vain because you weren't sincere. You didn't really mean it. So lest that would happen and you break a commandment, the Jews from Ezra down say we won't say it at all. So if you go to a Jewish synagogue now and you see that Psalm 8 where it has two different words, Yahweh Adonai or Adenu, which means our God, Adonu, they won't say that. They'd say Adonai, Adonai, because the first word he doesn't say, lest you take it in vain. Now, because up until the 19th century, less than 100 years ago, nobody even wanted to guess how that word was said, some scholars began to say, well, let's guess and put it together. So they got the word Yahweh, and that's what the Jerusalem Bible uses. If I read the first line, first two verses in Psalm 103, bless Yahweh, my soul, bless his holy name, all that is in thee. Bless Yahweh, my soul, and remember all his kindnesses. That's the Jerusalem translation. The Catholics and the Protestants have sort of decided that Y-A or J-A, you can spell it either way, depending on how Germanic you want to be. Some people spell it with a J, some people spell it with a Y. The actual transliteration from the Hebrew ought to be a J, but J-A, you got to get to be German to really say it right, otherwise, because it should be Yah, Yah, like in your. Now, back to Jehovah. If you aren't saying it, and you have your Jewish synagogue prayer book or psalm book, what do? You want to say Adonai. Every time you see that, you want to say that. So, the Bible got pointed. The vowels got put in. Hebrew was originally written without any vowels at all. So that if you saw a word like this, you'd have to be a good guesser by the context to know whether that means abide with me, or bed, or it bodes ill, or I make a 5-no-Trump bid. All kinds of words, you see. But if you put an I in there, well, then most people know what it means. And so that's the way Hebrew was originally written. It was written like this. That's Yahweh. There's the J or the Y. That's the H. That's the W or the V. And this is another H. You can see those are somewhat related. Just my careless writing makes them look a little different. They're actually the same letter. I should put a little curve there just to be sure. So you know. Now what they did, they put some vowels down here. There's just some little chicken dots down there. And the Jehovah word comes by people reading that Hebrew pointing in psalm books and synagogue hymn books. And so they took the J and the short A and the H and the O and the V or the W and the A and the H. And you got Jehovah. So the word Jehovah doesn't exist in Hebrew. It doesn't exist in any language except German and English. Most other European languages and all Semitic languages don't use it at all. It doesn't even exist. Yahweh exists, even though we don't know how to pronounce it, we know how to look at it. But you see, they put these vowels under here to remind the Jews after the time of Ezra, don't you dare say that word, you might say it in vain. And so they substituted the word my Lord, this word. And these were little reminders. Don't say those, say these. Do you follow what I just said? Mm-hmm. Okay, now the Jerusalem Bible I like for that reason, because it tells you which name of God is being used. It says, oh Yahweh, and if we looked at Psalm 8 real quick, let's just go to it real quickly. Yahweh our Lord. And Lord has just the one L capitalized and the others are small. So you know exactly what they're trying to say. They're saying it exactly. I personally like the Jerusalem Bible as the best translation there is, but that's just a personal whim. I also like the RSV very much, and I'll tell you why as we go through this. Now, any questions so far? Now we're going to get to the first verse, or get past the first verse. If we don't finish the psalm, you know, we're just having Bible study. We're not trying to finish it. Look at that question.
Yeah. No.
Just getting more comfortable, okay. Any questions? Okay, now let's look at that first verse. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me, bless his holy name. Most Hebrew poetry doesn't have rhyme. There are a few rhymes occasionally happening, and there are a few times in which the first letters of the line are the same. Alliteration and acrostics, that's sometimes they use. They don't have moon, spoon, love, dove, and above, and all that kind of stuff. And of course, modern verse, if you heard Karen Wee last night, she didn't have much rhyme either. So Hebrew doesn't. Hebrew poetry is parallel. An idea is expressed, and then either it's added to, or it's illustrated, or it's reduplicated. Reduplicated is sort of means it's going to happen more than once. It's duplicated. And so that's what you have here. The first line, any of you used to sing some of those songs I sang when I was growing up? The last verse, the same as the first. Do you remember singing something like that in one of the, what was that, 49 bottles on the row? Is that the one it goes to? The last verse is the same as the first. Well, anyhow, we use that as a chorus at the end sometimes. And so what we say about this is, not only in this psalm is the last verse the same as the first, but often the last half says the same as the first half of a line, and that's Hebrew poetry. Bless the Lord, O my soul. All that is within me, bless his holy name. Now, we've got a couple of things there. Holy name is parallel with Lord, right? They're equal. How about the other? My soul and all that is within me. I think they're saying the same thing. You might not agree with me, but I think they're saying the same thing. In other words, if I bless the Lord with all my soul, and if I bless his holy name with all that is within me, it just means everything about me. I said it last week, and I'll say it again. I really think it would be helpful if we got the word soul out of the English language for Bible translation. It has so many overtones that people go way off and get confused. The RSV and the Jerusalem Bible and many of the other new translations in Genesis 2 don't use man became a living soul. They say man became a living being. A being is a better translation. We talk about the totality. Luther talked about the totality of man. The Old Testament talks about the totality of man. And now most modern medicine and psychology and psychiatry is talking about, I'm a totality. I'm not stuck together like a fly on a flypaper, and then God releases the fly of my soul to go up to heaven and leaves the flypaper to disintegrate down in the grave. Or resurrection is to relaminate me and make me a piece of plywood again. That's the image that soul and body often give us. And that isn't really what the Bible says, Old or New Testament. So if you could define soul as your total beingness, which is what the second half of that verse says, doesn't it? All that is within me. Okay? Now, we could spend the rest of the day talking about body and soul. If you want to, we can do that. But I'd rather not go much farther than that. But if you have a specific question, I'll be glad to work on that one. Yeah?
I'm curious to ask, and you didn't want to do this, but how did that idea of soul get into the English?
It's very, very simple. Even though we were celebrating St. Jerome today, he wasn't the first one to translate the Bible. He was the first one in the West to translate it into the common language of Latin. But there were Jews as well as Christians who translated it into Greek and into Slavonic. There were other translations long before Jerome. The Greek Old Testament that was translated before the time of Christ took a Greek word for the Hebrew word beingness. And because the Greeks did, with Plato and Aristotle, divide human beings into either two or three parts, depending on which Greek philosopher you believe, they took the word, which is in our word psychology. The study of the soul is what that originally meant. The study of the psuche. Psuche is the Greek word. And the word for being, and I won't bother putting it up, I'll pronounce it, but it's not important. It's the word nephesh. That's the Hebrew word. So everywhere these Jews translated into Greek, they used souke. So by the time we translated souke into Greek, and then we got English, we got soul. Because that's what it meant in Greek philosophy. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
And so in Greek philosophy, souls are up there. Souls are separate from this terrible thing called body. And from all sin is bodily in many theologies and philosophies. And soul and spirit is wonderful. And that's how it got in. And unfortunately, we have a hard time getting away from it. Yes?
I mean, yeah. The separation of body and soul.
Yeah. That's what you've been taught, and that's what I was taught. If you read both Genesis 2:7 and Ecclesiastes 12:7, which are both passages about life and death, you'll recognize that what we've done over the years is to confuse the word soul with God's spirit. It was the spirit of God that breathed breath into the dust and made us a living being. He didn't give us a soul. He made us a living being. Ecclesiastes reverses that thing and says, when the silver cord is broken and the golden bowl is broken and the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, then the dust returns to the earth from which it came, and the spirit, not soul, the spirit returns to God who gave it. That's the separation.
The body and soul or the spirit will be
reunited. Yeah, but the spirit, you see, spirit is not mine. The spirit is God's vital power that made me me. In other words, I wouldn't be me without the creative power of the Spirit of God. And when God pulls that out from under me, I'm dead.
Right, but
that spirit isn't mine to keep. It isn't my identity. Yeah, right.
Will be
new me. I'd rather say new me to keep us from getting mixed up in body and soul again.
Yeah, but there's where
So at resurrection, we've never been able to define what a glorified body is. I'd rather make it clear that it's a glorified me.
Well, that's easier to understand than the dead.
Right. Trying to put everything back together again. You know, my father, for the first 20 years of his ministry, wouldn't perform funerals for people who were cremated, because he thought in the late 19th and early 20th century, cremation was thumbing your nose at God's resurrection powers. You know, because they were saying, you know, if we scatter it over Lake Chelan, and then the trout eat it, and then people at Holden eat it, and then they have deer and bears eat what they leave, you know, God's going to have a hell of a time putting us back together. And that was really behind it. You know, that's really behind it. I'm not being funny. That was really behind it. My father was serious about that. And that's, you know, that's the thing that causes the trouble. Now, you know, if resurrection is recreation, revivifying the me in a new and a glorified existence, I don't have to worry about where I'm scattered. You know, I've got in my pocket a living organ donor blank, which says that they can have any of my organs that they think are still worthwhile after 65, you know, that they can use, whether they can use my eyes or my kidneys or whatever, they can have them. Okay, well, you know, living organs, even autopsies are opposed by some people, because, you know, what's God going to do if they don't have their kidneys anymore when you get resurrected? But, you know, before, when we had to have the body resurrected in a particular way and soul poured back in or slapped back on, I don't know which image you want to use, you know, donations and autopsies were sort of almost as bad as cremation. But if I believe that, that's too slow. If I believe resurrection and creation and revivification is God's power, so that by his spirit, Omhal becomes Omhal again in a new and glorified existence. Just like Jesus could pass through doors. I don't know whether there are any doors in heaven to pass through, but anyhow, since we can't explain what glorified body means, why don't we just say a recreated me? It's a much simpler concept to hang on to. God recreates me. You look like you have a question.
No.
No? Okay, I thought you were, looked like you were in trouble there. Okay, we won't spend any more time on that. It'll come up again when we deal with Psalm 22 a little bit. Okay, now the word name. We may not get very far in this psalm. Bless the Lord, which means the covenant God, the one who made the covenant with Moses and with the Israelites. Bless his holy name. Now, you've found my name, and I told you what it means. Most names mean something. But in the Old Testament and among most Semitic people, a name had more to do than just a title or a handlebar or an identification mark. You know, we could use social security numbers instead of names if we wanted to just be identified. But a name had something to do with purpose, orientation, goals in life, which may have been assigned by the mother, had a prayer for the child. You know, she names him because of what she wants to happen, and it's sort of an ongoing prayer that this is what's going to happen. Let's just indicate this. A change of a name, therefore, means a change of orientation. Remember a guy named Jacob who wasn't a very nice guy and who was a sort of a sneak thief and a double crosser and a few other things that we could call him if we wanted to get all our name calling out of our system this morning? But he wrestled with an angel and got his name changed. What was his name changed to? Israel. Israel. Why? Because he was no longer Jacob, the heel catcher, which is what it means, or the supplanter, or the double crosser. You can translate it any of those three ways, and maybe other ways too. He was now the one who had encountered God. And the King James says, and prevailed. He prevailed in the sense that he got a blessing. So he was blessed with God and he had an orientation. Why did Jesus change a guy's name from Simon to Peter? Not because he wanted to make him Pope, but for what reason? What? He was strong, and he had made a certain confession, and Jesus recognized that there was a change in his orientation, a change in his purpose. Now, that's true also of the word Jesus itself. You know, whether that's exactly the way it was pronounced, Jesus, Isaiah, Joshua, Hosea, all those words are related to salvation or deliverance. And so Luke says, they call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins. Interesting, isn't it? They've already given you his purpose, his goal, and his history once they've named him.
But we're talking about to say Jesus the Christ.
All right, that's easy. Jesus is the one who was incarnate, became man, born of the Virgin Mary, died, rose. Now, Paul likes to use the word the Christ as a title. And the reason a lot of people are now getting, and I'm not this persnickety about it, if you know what the word persnickety means. I would say Jesus Christ, okay. But the reason people are saying it is that because I'm Umhal Wolf, a lot of people thought Jesus Christ were the two names, you know, first and last names. But Christ is a title. Jesus is the name, Christ is the title. The Messiah, the Anointed One, the Christos in Greek. So it's a title. And so some pastors and some liturgists are emphasizing to use the Paul phrase. And Paul always does. He says, the Christ. He always has a definite article in front of it. Because there isn't a Christ around. There's only the Christ. I say both myself. And, you know, I'm not against people saying Jesus, the Christ, always. But then I don't get upset about saying Jesus Christ either. Just like I don't get upset about saying Xmas or writing Xmas. Some people are purists and worry about Xmas. But X is just the abbreviation for the first two letters in English or the first letter in Greek. And the Kairo, nobody objects to the X and the R on the altar clause, which is using an X for the same thing, you know, Christ the King or just the first two letters. C-H-R, you can have both ways of explaining that if you want to, but you know, if you're going to object to Xmas, you got to take all the X's off your altar cloths because it's the same symbol. But if somebody wants to say, I'm never going to say Xmas, that's all right. That's, you know, that's their choice. But I can write Xmas, or I frequently write X for Christ when I'm writing, so I save chalk. since we only got four halves to last us for the rest of the week. Okay, anything else about name? In other words, when you're blessing the name of God, you're thanking him, you're praising him for his purpose, for his orientation toward his people, for his making a covenant with you. You're not just blessing Yahweh, 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 Yahweh. You're not just making a chant of about names. You're not just saying, oh, I thank you for your name, God. I thank you for these syllables, God. You're saying, I thank you. And it's shorthand in a way. It's shorthand for saying, I thank you for everything you've promised to do and have done. That's what the name of God is. And then he goes on in the next verse. We're going to move. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and now you move. And forget not all his benefits. Now the King James doesn't have the right punctuation. The RSV doesn't have the right punctuation. They use commas. But the Jerusalem Bible has the right punctuation. Now again, just like they didn't have vowels in Hebrew, they didn't have punctuation in Hebrew or Greek in the Bibles. So when you put punctuation in a translation, it's editorializing right away. Put quotations around something, you're editorializing. You put a comma, you're editorializing. You put an exclamation point, you're editorializing. Put a question mark, you're editorializing. You can't always tell in Hebrew and Greek. The Jerusalem Bible has a colon. I happen to agree with that idea. If you don't want to put a colon, you insist on having commas, as if the comma were inspired by David too, then put another word in. Forget not all his benefits, comma, namely, comma. And then you've got a list coming on. Because immediately thereafter, you're telling about what his benefits. Now, in Latin, the word benefit means good deeds. The things that have been done that are good and well and are out of grace. Benefit for most Americans means the Eastern Star or the American Legion's card party. You know, it's a benefit for the dependents of the American Legion boys. Who are no longer boys, most of them anymore. So, you know, even that word benefit is a lousy word anymore. Just like soul, you see, meanings of words and the use of words change. If I were invited to a benefit, I wouldn't think I was going to church. Would you? You'd think you were going to the lodge hall, or down to the Legion hall, or you were going down to a civil rights fundraising. All kinds of possibilities. But if I say something different, I would be all this. So the RSV still has benefits. But the Jerusalem Bible says, remember all his kindnesses. That gets a little bit closer to the significance. And then they have the colon. And then they don't say who forgives, who redeems, who crowns, who heals, who satisfies. They use participles. They say, in forgiving, in curing, in redeeming, in crowning, in filling, in renewing. Which, again, you get the idea of a series a little bit easier. Now you can look at that list of 3, 4, and 5, and you could do what I did with verse 1, or you could do something different with it. You could say they're all saying the same thing. And they are. You know, the first verse is the same as the last, and the last verse is the same as the first. If you don't know what the first part of a verse means, read the second part, you'll understand. Or you can say they're just adding another thought in the series. And you can go both ways, and it'll come out even, because you're saying the same thing. Remember, Jesus did it once. Whether it is easier to say, take up your bed and walk, or your sins be forgiven you. Mach's nix is the old German phrase my mother used to use. Doesn't make a darn bit of difference. For God, who is the covenant God, to heal my body or to forgive my sins is the same thing. For God, who is the covenant God, to rescue me from the grave or to crown me with his love is the same thing. Just as easy for him to save me from a terminal illness or to rescue me from my enemies who are trying to kill me as it is to sit me on a throne and give me a crown. It's all the same thing. So you can say these are 6 different acts of God, or you can say there's six ways of saying how God cares for his covenant people. Six ways of saying it doesn't necessarily mean there's six different things. I was very careful as to how I put that. There could be six things he does for us, or six ways of saying how he cares. Just look at them. I won't go through them all. The first one is he forgives all your iniquity. And the word iniquity is a very simple word here. It's the word for breaking something, breaking a commandment, breaking the covenant laws. It's not the word for sin. Otherwise, they translate it. Both the RSV and the King James are relatively consistent when they use the word. Iniquity does not mean sin. Sin normally means rebellion in the Old Testament, alienation of affections, going after other gods or ignoring other gods, healing all your diseases. If you want to know more about sin, just read Psalm 51. Psalm 51 talks about sin and iniquities and all kinds of evil and that sort of stuff. It has the whole set. Who redeems your life from the pit? We can try and find out what the pit is if you want by looking at Psalm 16, verse 10. Someone want to turn to that one for me fast? Psalm 16, verse 10. And remember the little phrase we've used before. If you don't know what it means, you look at the next half of the verse. Psalm 16, verse 10.
For thou dost not give me up to Sheol.
All right, Sheol.
Mm-hmm. Or let thy godly one see the pit.
Okay, so pit could mean Sheol. We could go to another psalm and find out that Sheol maybe means the grave. Or pit
mine
means.
Says undergo decay.
Undergo decay, right, which mm-hmm. normally happens when they stick us in a grave, right,
mm-hmm.
or in a tomb.
For thou wilt not leave my soul in hell.
Okay, hell is the stronger phrase, which is an editorializing, because the Hebrews did not, except very late in their life, know the word Hades or hell. Sheol they used, which was a place that didn't have good or bad in it. It was just a place like gathered to my fathers. I'm gathered to my fathers, I'm going to go down in the mausoleum where there are a lot of places where they can stack us three on a time, and then there's another hole for three more and another hole for three more. And maybe you can get up to 24 and four or five generations. So I'm gathered to my fathers. They're all there waiting for me. They didn't have a strong afterlife. So when you see the word hell in a King James Version or in a more conservative translation, that's an editorialized translation. There was no hell in pre-Persian Old Testament. That's a very strong statement to make. But gotta say it. There is a word Hades and there is a hell in New Testament and in Christian theology, but the Old Testament didn't have a strong sense of afterlife. Just like your Jewish friends don't have a strong sense of afterlife. Their continuance is in their children, or in the Jewish people, or in the state of Israel. One of those three, and sometimes all three, is how they get their immortality, if you want to put it.
Yes, but in Job, he certainly had a sense of immortality.
Unfortunately, you read your translations and your footnotes.
I know that my Redeemer liveth, and from the last day I will see him. Is that the last day on earth?
It says the latter day, but that's all right, last day. That might be the last day of me, right? And it says, even in English, it's unclear. But we always have thought it's clear. And from my flesh, I will see God. What does from my flesh mean? I'm still alive, or I'm out of it? So you can't tell. And if you look in most of the footnotes of Job 19, it'll say the Hebrew is very unclear. Oh, yeah, a lot of people like it. And it says a lot of things that Christians can believe. I'm not saying we don't believe it. I'm just saying Job didn't teach it clearly enough that we know. Let's go back to Psalm 103, and it'll help you with Job, I think. Look at just above what we talked about, the pit. In curing all your diseases, in redeeming your life from the pit. What's he saying? If I cure your diseases, I save you from the grave, right? If I don't cure your diseases, you're going to end up in the pit. Or the pits. Right? So what he's praying for is deliverance from death. But he's not praying for resurrection as such. There are only two passages in the whole Old Testament that are clearly resurrection of the individual. One's in Isaiah 26 and the other's in Daniel. I think it's Daniel 12. But I'd have to look it up real quick. There are two other passages that use resurrection as an illustration of restoration of Israel. You know, restore the nation after they've been in the Babylonian captivity. That's the Valley of Dry Bones in Ezekiel. And the story that's quoted frequently in the New Testament about Christ's resurrection, they're using an illustration from the book of Hosea. And on the third day, they use a third day illustration. In other words, in a short time, Israel will be restored. In a short time, God will go after that a whoring bunch of Israelites and bring them back to him and love them anyhow, because he just can't give them up. Now that's used in the New Testament about Jesus' resurrection. That's when God did get all these people back through Christ's resurrection and followed through. I don't want to take a favorite passage away from you. I really don't. Because Job does say what many Christians believe in the King James translation. If you look at it in other translations, well, let's just, you know, the Catholics aren't known for their conservatism, are they? Let's just see if I can find Job here real quick. Okay, verse 25 in Job 19, and this is even making the word last different than I would make it. I would say in the latter days, meaning just before I die, I will get a glimpse of his rescue. But here's the way they say it. This I know, that my avenger lives, and he, the last, will take his stand on earth. After my awakening, he will set me close to him, and from my flesh I shall look on God. He whom I shall see will take my part. In other words, he's got to defend me and take care of what? Does that satisfy you? Fine. Okay. You like that. Good. Okay. I meant to show you the other thing about here. He says the word avenger and take his stand are technical legal terms. And if you look in the RSV, just for fun, you know, one of the problems about the RSV, although I like it, and we'll get to a word that I like in a couple of minutes if we get that far. The footnote on the RSV on that verse, for I know that my Redeemer lives, and there's a footnote, you, it says then it could be vindicator, and at last he will stand upon the earth, and after my skin has been destroyed, then without my flesh I shall see God. It says, or from my skin, and then it says, the meaning of this verse is uncertain in the footnote. And that's about as honest as you can be.
But well, we don't know what they thought.
Yeah, right, we don't. And you see, the dilemma that Old Testament scholars and Christians have is that if you say this must be a resurrection passage, then you go against some of the other conservative Christian point of view, which says Job is an early story. You know, then you have things going a little bit in cycle, because Daniel and Isaiah are relatively late, whereas Job is normally thought to be an early story. And it's a tough question. But I'd rather say it this way. I'd rather say that my recreation and my redemption from sin and my redemption from death is all the act of a loving God, and I don't have to know all the details of how it's going to be done. Right. However he does is good enough for me. And that's about where I am on it, without trying to go into real details about it. Okay, we may even get to another verse yet. I don't know whether we need to talk about who satisfies you with good as long as you live. I think verse 4 I should mention. Who crowns you with steadfast love and mercy is the translation in the RSV. And crowning you with love and tenderness is the passage in the Jerusalem Bible. I don't like loving kindness, and when back in 1958 or 9 I went around trying to convince some of the King James people that the RSV was a good version, and it was at that time, and still is. I said to some people, if they had only done one thing, this would sell me on the RSV, and that was to change the word loving kindness to steadfast love. Loving kindness doesn't quite say it. Steadfast love is the story of Hosea all over. It's a story of the hound of heaven that Thompson writes of in English literature, that he's going to go after me even though I keep running away. He's steadfastly my covenant God. He pursues me. He wants to save me. He wants to deliver me. He wants me to be his. He wants to have me in heaven with him if we want to move into another part of the development of the doctrine of the afterlife. And steadfast love is a beautiful word for me. Now, those first five verses make a paragraph, if you want to put it. And then 6 to 10 is the basis of, why do I have the hope that he'll follow me? Why do I have the hope? It's the same kind of hope that we have in some other psalms, even Psalm 22, which some people think is a hopeless psalm, but isn't. It's got a lot of hope. They always give a reason why you dare trust. Here he says, he made his ways known to Moses and his acts to the people of Israel. They know he's that kind of a deliverer. He's that kind of healer. He's that kind of provider. He's that kind of savior. And you know, it's still the Lord. The Lord is merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. He will not always chide nor keep his anger forever. He does not deal with us according to our sins, nor requite us according to our iniquity. And that's it. And then we get into what is clear. Well, let's move back to Psalm 22 briefly. In Psalm 22, one of the problems that that psalmist has is he lists about our fathers trusted in you and they were saved. What's wrong with me that you haven't saved me yet? You know, I trust, but you haven't done something. And then he gets into the business, gee, I must not even be a human being. I'm a worm. God doesn't save worms, he says to himself. He saves human beings and Israelites. And if he hasn't saved me yet, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? A covenant God doesn't forsake his people, this psalmist is saying. I've been forsaken. I must not be a human being. I must not have a God. Because he goes through all these. Our fathers trusted. They were delivered. How come I am not? And you've got the same thing here, but it's in a different mood. The one is a lament and a prayer for deliverance. Here's a praise saying, I know I'm delivered. I've been delivered. I know that he did it to Moses. He did it for Israel. He's done it always. And he obviously isn't going to hurt me now. And then we get into the imagery of forgiveness. As far as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his steadfast love to those who fear him. As far as the east is from the west, so far does he remove our transgressions from us. As a father pities his children, so the Lord pities those who fear him. He knows our frame and remembers we are dust. Start from the 14th and go backwards. He knows I'm mortal. He knows that without his power and his spirit, I'm just dust. They then talk about how short our life is in the next couple of verses after that. You come back to verse 13. You got the whole story of the prodigal son. The father who loves, the father who pities, the father who forgives. The Lord forgives. The Lord pities. Up in verse 3, we have the word he forgives. Down in verse 11, we get the and verse 12, we get the definition of forgiveness. Actually, the word forgive up in 3 literally means he removes. He removes all your iniquity. That would be a literal translation. And then in verse 12, he really says it. As far as east is from the west, so far does he remove our transgressions. Now, the word transgressions is the word for rebellion. It's the word for Isaiah chapter 1. The ox knows its master, the ass its owner's crib, but thou dost not know. Or the earlier verse, I have nourished children and they have rebelled against me. Best definition of sin anywhere in the Old or New Testament. Romans 1 is almost as good. But Isaiah 1 really says it all. And whenever in the King James or the RSV you see the word transgression or transgressions, translate it rebellion or rebellions. And I only can rebel once. I'm just one great big rebellion. So it's my rebellion if it's got a singular pronoun, but here it says our rebellions, which means the nation or the family or the people. I've rebelled. So they're, my rebellions are going to be moved from me as far as the east is from the west. And then, you know, that was long before we knew that the earth was round, so he really didn't move them all the way around so that they got back together again. They were thinking in terms of the flat earth, and so as far as you go from the east is the west, their consideration, their images, you can't take it any further than that. Or you can't take it any further than the heavens are higher above the earth. You know, he's using imagery to say, it's moved infinitely away from me, as far as it could possibly be moved. Okay, then we talked about he knows our frame, and then 15 and 16 tell us about that. We don't last very long. We're like some of the flowers that grow up here, and they have a short growing season, and they're pretty well shot. But, and again, the but is an editorial, but I think it's okay. There are no words like but in Hebrew. There's just a word that says connective. And it can be translated but, and, or, however, nevertheless, or any of the other connectives. Just one little connective word that they use. And so you have to editorialize. And I think but's okay. I also think but is good in the 19th verse of Psalm 22 that we'll get to Saturday if you're still here. But note, you see, verse 18. Those who keep his covenant and remember to do his commandments. Remember is an active verb in the Old Testament. It isn't an intellectual verb. In fact, to say remember to do is almost redundant. Psalm 8, what is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him? And in another translation it says, what is man that thou rememberest him? A long, long time ago, a man who wasn't an Old Testament scholar, but a good Christian, Roger Babson, said about this phrase, the remember, when God remembers, he does things. And then he adds the phrase, I'll never forget, there's never a dull moment when Yahweh is around. In other words, he's not sitting up in heaven or wherever he sits, just thinking about me. He's always doing something. Now, when I remember, I can get nostalgic and remember and do absolutely nothing about it. Just sometimes I don't even have emotions about it. It's just plain historical reverie. But when God remembers, he does something about it. So, when you get the New Testament statement about he remembers Abraham, his covenant with Abraham, you remember in the beginning of Luke, when he says he remembers it, doesn't mean, gee, I forgot those people. I should have come back sooner. No, it doesn't. It says, I'm going to do something. I'm going to send my son. And that's part of his remembering. His remembering is an action verb. His remembering isn't an intellectual verb. And so that's what it says for us too. We remember to do his commandments. And then we've got his kingdom. We know the Lord and all that. And then you get to the end, which is somewhat like the last verse, is the same as the first. Bless the Lord, O ye his angels, you mighty ones who do his work, hearkening to the voice of his word. Then bless the Lord, all his hosts. And here you got another one where you can get yourself upset if you want to, but it's just unclear. Do hosts mean angels, the starry heavens? Does it mean the armies of the Israelites? The word is unclear. I think you could say it probably means angels because of the next half of the verse. Bless the Lord all his hosts, who are his hosts, his ministers that do his will. I doubt if the ministers were the generals and the corporals in the army. Now they might have occasionally thought of themselves that way, but I doubt of it. And then bless the Lord all his works in all places of his dominion. And then bless the Lord all of me, or O my soul. It's obviously, isn't it, a hymn of praise for the mighty acts of God, a hymn of praise for God's forgiveness, for God's covenant, and the use of the word Lord, Yahweh, all the way through, is a good clue to that. Because when it isn't a psalm of trust for a covenant God, you don't use that word. You don't say, just like we don't say the Christ if we don't believe he's the Messiah. Now, time's almost up, or is up, depending on how you count your clock. Are there some questions about this? This is one of the most familiar psalms for many of us, and maybe you didn't have as much new to learn today, but I hope it was of some help.